And frankly, I almost don't think it really matters who it is, whether it's Democrat or Republican, because as I've said so often here and in other places, Democrat and Republican is just two wings of the same bird of prey. They're selected, at least in terms of the president, selected.
Well, we see that right now with regard to the present leadership. Here we
Right.
have the so-called leader of the Democrats, President Obama, working hand in hand with the leaders of the Republican Party in the Senate and the House. Mitch McConnell went off script and committed a truth here not too long ago. He said he was in a press conference. This was a couple of months ago. I quote him in my articles. He said, "This is an enormous grant of power from a Republican Congress to a Democratic president," talking about the TPA. And he said, "So we're being very bipartisan on this." Well, that was really not the best thing to say, Mitch, when all the rest of the party is saying, "Oh, this isn't a grant of power to the president." That, in fact, Paul Ryan, the chairman of the House Ways and Means, Republican, has a web page on the House Ways and Means. The whole web page is said, "Empower Congress, pass the TPA." He's saying that by passing the fast track, we're empowering Congress. Mitch McConnell is saying we're empowering the president. Yes, it is a tremendous transfer of power from the House of Representatives, which under our Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, says that Congress shall regulate commerce between the nation, among the nations. So under the Constitution, that's supposed to be Congress's role. Also under the Constitution, since these treaties, since these so-called free trade agreements actually are treaties, they're hybrid agreements which put together actual legislation with treaty powers, then the Senate has to approve it by a two-thirds majority. And of course, that's not what they're doing with fast track. They're just doing simple majority in both houses and under expedited schedules. So, yeah,
As we've
the
seen historically, though, a constitution is only as it only has as much force as the government that's willing to enforce it. And
or
so, for
as the
example, the Soviet
people are
Constitution.
willing to hold the government accountable, because that's what Madison himself said, and that's what Hamilton said, that you cannot put any trust in parchment restrictions, parchment barriers, he said, because simply putting on parchment that the government shall be divided into three branches with three powers, legislative, executive, and judicial, and this branch shall only do this, and this branch shall, that doesn't mean anything unless it is enforced, unless it is abided by those who have sworn allegiance to it and those who elect those they put in positions of power. So if we're too busy distracting ourselves with other things and allowing them to do what they will, then the Constitution is not a self-enforcing document. It's not going to prevent them from committing national suicide for us. So, this should have been brought home very clearly just in the last couple of weeks, because we had a major case brought before our eyes when the WTO, the World Trade Organization, which is a global institution set up under the United Nations during the and we signed on to it during the Clinton administration, when the WTO, a tribunal, a court of the WTO, ruled just about 3 weeks ago that a U.S. law known as COOL, the country of origin labeling, was illegal and had to be struck down. Now, why is that important to Americans? Well, if you are concerned about where your meat comes from, whether it be pork or chicken or beef, and you want to know if it's coming from China or if it's coming from Malaysia or if it's coming from Vietnam or coming from Mexico, the country of origin labeling law forces those who are importing the meat to simply state where this meat was raised and where it is originating from. there's no real restraint of trade there. It's not saying you can't come in if you're from those countries. It's saying if you're going to bring it in from those countries, Americans have a right to know where it's coming from. Guess what? McDonald's and Walmart and Burger King and the U.S. Cattlemen's Association, which is the big corporate interest, not the actual mom and pop and family farms and ranches that raise, they put up a big stink. They were opposed to this labeling because they want to be able to bring in all the foreign meat products that they can. And so Canada and Mexico brought lawsuits against the United States, supported by all of these big corporate interests, and charging that this was in violation of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. It's been in force now for over 20 years, 25 years. And they brought that before U.S. federal court. Our courts upheld it, said it's a legal constitutional law, there's nothing to it. Well, they took it then to the World Trade Organization. And 3 weeks ago, the World Trade Organization said, nope, can't do it. So the very next day, let's see, that was on May 18th. Then the very next day, on May 19th, the House Committee on Agriculture put forward a bill to say, okay, we're going to repeal our law, country of origin labeling. American said, we don't want to have any beef with the WTO. The WTO has ruled, we have to abide by their ruling. And so they have actually introduced legislation to repeal the country of origin labeling, so you won't be able to tell where your meat is coming from. That is what we will find happening with regard to all of our laws that are going to be challenged. And it does not just affect consumer laws like that, but we will find, as in the European Union, that the militant pro-abortion, the militant population control, the militant homosexual lobbies, all of them will be challenging our laws, claiming that they violate human rights and that that's part of the violation of what they call the upward harmonization of all of our laws and regulations.
And not only in social spheres such as that one, but also in the financial sector, this is going to be a worry. So right after the 2008 financial collapse, they started putting in different rules. Congress enacted various legislation to try to prevent the same type of things that led to the 2008 financial collapse. I mean, one of the principal things was Bill Clinton and his free trade boy, Larry Summers, got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act from the Roosevelt era, which kept a firewall between depositors' money and investment banks, so that now the banks could bail in all their depositors into derivatives and toxic assets and everything else. So then you have legislation that came in 2008 designed to try to, it didn't quite do it, but to try to bring that back in. And so now you have corporations, including the banks, which apparently are being given free rein under the TPP to challenge United States laws in the financial realm. You have the potential for the average consumer to be bailed in by this TPP, by this international board. What else can happen financially to us?
Well, it's a good thing you brought that up. One of the, we just mentioned the WTO and the COOL law. That is a case of where a free trade agreement, a so-called free trade agreement, NAFTA, was used by partners in NAFTA, Canada and Mexico, challenged in court a U.S. law. They took it, first went to the U.S. courts, then it was bumped up to the WTO. NAFTA has its own tribunals that have ruled against the United States as well. The TPP and TTIP have their own tribunals, but they can bump it up to the WTO. So we could have it ruled against us in the TPP and TTIP. The main tribunal that has received attention across, again, from opponents across the spectrum has been the ISDS, the Investor State Dispute Settlement Tribunal, ISDS. And again, This gets to an issue of sovereignty. Who actually gets to make the final decision in an area? When we have in a nation state, every nation state has its own judicial system. We have courts that have their own areas of jurisdiction over state law here in the United States, or provincial law in Canada, etc. And if it is actionable, then at the federal level, it goes up to the federal court system, ultimately to the Supreme Court. And in these systems, what you have is a whole system of judicial institutions that are being set up to overrule local, state, and federal laws. So I've quoted a number of the legal scholars who point out, well, yeah, if you're going to have these international agreements, you have to have these international judicial structures. And that then begs the question, it leads to, well, we need some kind of international polity or political structure then, because the judicial structure is rather naked without an overall legislative and executive authority as well. So that is where this is leading to. So what is that? That's actually, they call it global governance or global government. And that's where this is leading. Inevitably, inexorably, that's where that leads to. And what that means for us on the financial level is what we are seeing now in Europe. Most people have probably forgotten, if they saw it in the news cycle between all the other things that we've previously mentioned. In 2013, Cyprus, country of Cyprus, experienced their a banking meltdown. Their debt crisis got to the position that they were facing national bankruptcy, primarily because the Cyprus banks and the European banks and a number of American banks had sold bonds and had been involved in helping push all of the bad debt that Cyprus was piling up. So what happened in 2013? We had one of the first national bail-ins, and that is, we're all familiar with the term bailout since 2008, since the crisis, where all of these banking institutions that were in trouble, the too big to fail banks, Goldman Sachs, Chase, Citibank, Morgan Stanley, etc. We were told, well, if these banks fall, It will put everything at systemic risk, and we face a total economic collapse. So they have to be bailed out by the taxpayers. Well, then we had bailout two, bailout three, bailout four. We had to bail out the European banks, and taxpayers are getting a little bit fed up with all these too big to fail bailouts. So with the Cyprus case, they began what they first called a bail-in, in which rather than go to the taxpayers, they say, okay, well, we'll just confiscate the savings of the depositors in the banks in Cyprus. And that's what they did. And so they just simply closed the banks, and people ran to the banks, to the ATMs to get their money out. The bank doors were closed. The ATMs were not working. And then they're told, we're going to sort this out. And what they did was like a bank and several of the big banks, people lost 70, 80, 90% or 100% of their savings. A few of the big favored banks, the Goldman Sachs, the types of banks like the Bank of Cyprus, those folks only lost 10 or 20 or 30% of their savings. Government simply took it and paid off the banks and the big depositors with the little guy's money. So they call it euphemistically a haircut, or they call it a one-time bank levy. But more formally, they refer to it as a wealth tax. That sounds good because it makes it sound like we're just taxing the wealthy. But most of the people who lost their money in the Cyprus bail-in were just ordinary savers, people like you and me who didn't have that much in the bank. And that's why I've been saying for the last several years, even before the Cyprus thing, if you have money in the bank, you should have only that which you need to carry out your regular transactions. You should not have any money there in the bank, but they're not safe if you have them in other paper assets as well, particularly the biggest share of money that folks have of their savings, which are in pensions, because pension funds are one of the next big areas that the governments of the world, the bankers of the world, are going to be taking. They're going to be confiscating people's pension funds. We already have seen this happen in Argentina and in Poland and in other places. And in my article on this about the IMF turning it into the global Fed, go into the Cyprus case, and then a quote from the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and various proponents and propagandists for it that say this has to go global. This is we really need to repeat this on a global scale because the whole financial system is at systemic risk, and the only way to solve this is to practice more of these bail-ins. So they're sending the signal that your bank account, your pension fund, your 401k, all of those things are, and it doesn't matter if it's a private pension fund or if it's a state pension or federal pension fund. If you can get your money or some of your funds out of there, it's my advice that it would be a very wise thing to do that.
There's a lot of people that are going to say, oh, this is America. That can't happen. I mean, come on now. I mean, we have laws against this thing. How likely is it, given the things we've just noted, that should there be some systemic collapse in Europe or in China, where, for example, we're seeing the price of oil is really low, and it's got to be killing the derivatives market and all the short selling and the different things that, although you see oil's going up, but it's been in decline for a while. So they say, okay, well, we need to bail in some part of the economy. So now everyone's in this TPP partnership. And they say, okay, well, America, it's time for you to help bail us out. So we're going to bail in, you know, how possible is it? And well, what's the vehicle for it? If they're going to say, we're going to bail in your pensions and all these things that, you know, into the whole system.
Well, we could look at precedent. In the digital age, yes, it's true that our financial matters are a bit more sophisticated. But you go back to the bail-in, the confiscation, back during the New Deal, when President Roosevelt simply said, okay, everybody turn in your gold. If you don't, you're a felon. You can be arrested. So everybody had to turn in their gold. Not only that, but all of the safety deposit boxes in the country were confiscated. And in fact, I remember in, I think it was 1979 or 80, anyway, I have the Wall Street Journal front page when here was, nearly 50 years later, when many of these safety deposit boxes were returned. Now, that, you know, when they confiscated the safety deposit boxes, it was supposedly to take gold and silver. But people had all kinds of stocks and other things in there as well. Stocks, bonds, heirlooms, grandmother's jewelry, various documents, birth certificates, things like that. All of those were kept as well. So, I mean, we've had that happen here in this country before. Now it would be much easier because they don't have to actually physically go. And I mean, that could still and probably still would happen where they go to the banks and freeze the safety deposit boxes, knowing that people still do put their assets such as gold, silver, jewelry, etc., in those places. But most people have their assets in paper digital assets that can be confiscated with the stroke of a key on a computer. And so that is very doable. And I submit it's not only doable, but it will be done. Many of the top financial advisors, Jim Rogers, for instance, said last year, or actually it was in 2013, it was after the Cyprus event, he said, this is going to be happening all over the world. They're going to be coming for it. He said, in America too. They're going to come and they're going to demand your money and they're going to take it. I believe that we are facing that. And if people are not prepared for it, and people have not are not even thinking about this ahead of time, if they're not already putting politicians on notice about this, they'll find that the politicians will think, okay, we can pull a fast one here, and before anyone knows anything about it or knows what to do, how to respond to it, we'll be able to have pulled this off. And so it's very important for people not to, first of all, leave themselves personally so vulnerable to this kind of a political criminal activity. This is really criminal activity. It's thievery on a scale far greater than any criminal cartel could pull off by hiring a bunch of thugs to go around do it. They already have their bureaucrat thugs in positions of power to carry this out. So it is a very real threat. And so I would urge people to who want to find out more about it to go online. This article is available at thenewamerican.com, and it links to many others that we've done on this over the last several years leading up to this.
And we'll also have it linked up in the interview notes afterward. So apart from the financial potentialities, there's also other specters of the horizon. So for instance, we saw in the last year or two, we had we had PIPA and SOPA, these treaties that would effectively control the internet to try to affect how users can use the internet. You now see in China, they're establishing an internet ID where you have to actually have your own login to even get on the internet, so that everything you do on the internet is now, you know, tracked exactly to you. So there's no VPNs, there's no anything. As soon as you get on, there you are. And in this country, you know, that's been talked about, you have these various cyber attacks, and some people have mused that the Internet Patriot Act has already been written, and it's just waiting to go to then require something similar to what they have in China. What does the TPP signal in terms of internet control? We had a big fulmination last year with with the FCC now putting, you know, proposing legislation for the internet.
Right.
What can the TPP do?
Right. Well, in fact, I don't have it right here in front of me, but our current issue of the magazine, our cover story by Mitchell Shaw, is precisely on that. He has two cover stories on that. And where we stand right now with the FCC under Obama, and with Republican support in many cases, pushing for the FCC to take over illegally, unconstitutionally, control over the internet. That is very far advanced. Some people say it's unstoppable right now. I don't believe that it is. I think that it can be stopped, particularly with if everyone who uses the internet gets on it now. And that's what we saw happen with SOPA and with all of the other legislative efforts to take over the internet over the last couple of years. The outcry was so great that the politicians backed off. So now you have the Obama's in the last leg of his term, and all of the bureaucrats working under him are willing to do his dirty work. So he is pushing for takeover of the internet. Now, we did a series of stories last year about the international effort under the United Nations to put the UN in control of the internet. And the Obama administration supported these efforts as well. And you started off by mentioning China. Well, incredibly, the big conference that they had in Istanbul, Turkey, last year, this big UN conference, was presided over by a Chinese communist who was in charge of this whole big UN effort to take control of the internet. And, you know, we've been covering this very extensively. People don't realize how far along that is as well. And so we have it, the effort to take control of the internet, both at the federal level with the FCC and with legislation that has failed thus far. But there's also then kicking it up a notch, the United Nations trying to take control of it as well. So both of those would be disastrous, of course, if the UN had control of the internet, or if the FCC, the federal government, had control over it. You know, the internet is a mixed bag. You and I both know there's plenty of bad stuff going on the internet, but it is a vehicle which allows you and me to carry on conversations like this, for millions of people to exchange information outside of the control of the establishment media, which we haven't seen them really exposing or reporting on any of those topics that we're discussing here. They have not alerted the people to the dangers of any of these internet control schemes. They have not, you haven't seen the New York Times or the LA Times or ABC, NBC, CNN, Fox News warn the American people about the TPP or the TTIP. Well, it doesn't happen. Their whole reason for existing is to distract us and keep us misguided, or to actually praise these efforts and promote them. So the internet and our ability to get out information around the controlled media is very important. That's why the big effort now to head this off and to put it under control as well, so that and if that happens, we will find ourselves becoming more and more like China, where you've probably read some of the stories. We've done stories on it over the last number of years, where people just simply got on the internet and sent an email, and in a very short time, there were jackbooted thugs at their door, dragging them off to jail. And that can happen here. It will happen here if we're not vigilant and don't fight to keep our rights to be able to communicate.